It is merely my German soul reviving, he told himself. It is the German nature to feel incomplete. On other nights, the great secret agent would take himself on reconnaissance through the Soviet sector, disguised in a green Tyrolean hat he had bought specially for the purpose, to observe from beneath its brim the stubby Russian sentries with their submachine guns posted outside the Soviet headquarters at 20-yard intervals down the street. If they challenged him, Pym had only to show his military pass for their Tartar faces to crack in friendly recognition as they took a pace back in their soft leather boots and tossed up a grey-gloved hand in salute. English good. But Russian good too, Pym would insist with a laugh. Russian very good, honestly. Kamerad. Tovarich. Kamerad. The great internationalist responded. He would offer a cigarette and take one. He would light them with his big flamed American Zippo lighter, obtained from one of the many clandestine merchants operating inside Div Int. He would let it glow on the sentry's features and his own. Then Pym, in his good-heartedness, had half an urge, though fortunately not the language, to explain that although he had spied on the communists at Oxford and was spying on them again in Vienna, he was still a communist at heart and cared more for the snows and cornfields of Russia than ever he did for the musical cocktail cabinets and roulette wheels of Ascot. And sometimes, very late, returning through empty squares to his monkish little bedroom with its army fire extinguisher and photograph of Rick, he would pause and drink the clean night air in gusts until he was elated and gaze down misted cobble streets and pretend that he saw Lipsy walking towards him through the lamplight in her refugee's headscarf, carrying her cardboard suitcase. And he would smile at her and valiantly congratulate himself that whatever his outward longings, he was still living in the world inside his head. He had been in Vienna 3 months when Marlena asked him for his protection. Marlena was a Czech interpreter and celebrated beauty.
"You are Mr. Pym?" she inquired one evening with a civilian's delightful shyness as he descended the great staircase behind a bevy of high-ranking officers.
She wore a baggy mackintosh nipped at the waist and a hat with little horns. Pym confessed that he was.
"You are walking to the Weichsel Hotel?"
Pym said that he did so every evening.
"You allow I walk with you, please? Once? Yesterday a man tried to rape me. You will guide me to my door? I am not trouble."
Soon the intrepid Pym was guiding Marlena to her door each evening, and collecting her from it in the mornings. His day unfolded between these radiant interludes. But when he invited her to have dinner with him after payday, he was summoned by a furious captain of fusiliers who had charge of new arrivals.
"You are a lecherous little swine, do you hear?"
"Yes, sir."
"Divint subalterns do not, repeat, not fraternize in public with civilian personnel. Not unless they put a lot more service in than you have, do you hear?"
"Yes, sir."
"Do you know what a shit is?"
"Yes, sir."
"No, you don't. A shit, Pym, is an officer whose tie is of a lighter khaki than his shirt. Have you seen your tie recently?"
"Yes, sir."
"Have you seen your shirt?"
"Yes, sir."
"Compare them, Pym, and ask yourself what sort of young officer you are. That woman isn't even cleared above restricted."
"It's all training," thought Pym, as he changed his tie. "I'm being hardened for the field." Nevertheless, it worried him that Marlena had asked him so many questions about himself, and he wished that he had not been quite so frank in his replies. Not long after this, Pym was mercifully deemed to have got the feel of the place. Before departing, he was again summoned by the captain, who showed him 2 photographs. One depicted a pretty young man with soft lips, the other a chubby drunk with a sneer.
"If you see either of these men, you will report that information to a senior officer immediately, do you hear?"
"Who are they?"
"Hasn't anyone taught you not to ask questions? If you can't find a senior officer, arrest them yourself."
"How?"
"Use your authority. Be courteous but firm. You are men under arrest. Then bring them to the nearest senior officer."
Their names, Pym learned a few days later from the Daily Express, were Guy Burgess and Donald MacLean, and they were members of the British Foreign Service. For several weeks he continued to look for them everywhere, but he never found them, because they had already defected to Moscow. "So which of us is responsible, Tom? Tell me.
Is it Pym's wistful soul, or God's wry humour, that contrived to deal him a spell of paradise before every fall? I told you of the Ollingers in Bern, that it was given to us once only in a lifetime to know a truly happy family. But I had forgotten Major Harrison Membury, formerly of the British Library in Nairobi, and one-time officer in the Education Corps, who had strayed by a delicious caprice of military logic into the ragtag ranks of field security. I had forgotten his beautiful wife and their many grimy daughters, who were Fräulein Ollingers in the making, except that they kept goats and a boisterous piglet in preference to making music, which made mayhem of their military hiring, to the rage of the garrison administration officer, who was powerless because the Membrys were intelligence and immune. I had forgotten Number 6 Field Interrogation Unit, Graz, a pink baroque villa in a wooded cleft of hills a mile from the city's edge. Bunches of telephone cable led into it. Aerials desecrated the spired roof. It had a gateway with a gatehouse and a wild-eyed blonde mess waiter called Wolfgang, who rushed down the steps in a pressed white coat to hand you out of your jeep. But the best thing about it, as far as Membury was concerned, was the lake, which he spent his days stocking, for he was mad on fish, and lavished a sizable part of our secret imprest on encouraging rare breeds of trout. You must imagine a big, genial man, quite strengthless, with the elegant gestures of an invalid, and of a dreamy, religious eye and disposition. A civilian to his soft fingertips, if ever I met one. Yet, when I see him now, it is always in army battle dress, with worn suede boots, and a webbing belt either above his belly or below it, standing amid the dragonflies at the edge of his beloved lake in the heat of a scorching afternoon. Exactly as Pym discovered him on the day he reported for duty, poking a thing like a shrimping net into the water, while he muttered shy imprecations against the marauding pike. "Oh, my goodness, you're Pym. Yes, well, so glad you've come. Look here, I'm going to clear away the weed and drag the whole bed to see exactly what we've got. What do you think of that?" "It sounds great, sir," said Pym. "I'm so glad. Are you married?" "No, sir." "Marvellous. Then you'll be free at weekends." And I think of him for some reason as one of a pair of brothers, though I don't recall ever hearing he had a brother. His home-based staff consisted of a sergeant, whom I barely remember, and a cockney driver called Kaufman, who had a degree in economics at Cambridge. His second-in-command was a pink-cheeked young banker named Lieutenant McLeod, who was returning to the city. In the cellars, dutiful Austrian clerks tapped telephones, steamed open mail, and dumped their unread product in a row of army dustbins, which were emptied by the Graz authorities punctiliously once a week, because it was a nightmare of memories that some fish-hating vandal would tip them in the lake. On the ground floor, he kept his stable of locally recruited lady interpreters, who ranged from the maternal to the nubile, and Membury, when he remembered their existence, admired them all. And finally he had his wife, Hannah, a painter of trees. And Hannah, as is so often the way with the wives of very large men, was as fragile as a wisp. Hannah made painting attractive to me, and I remember her best seated at her easel in a low white dress, while the girls rolled shrieking down a grass bank, and Membury and myself in bathing costumes toil in the brown water. Even today it is impossible to imagine her as the mother of all those daughters. The rest of Pym's life could scarcely have been more to his liking. For commodities, he had naffy whiskey at 7 shillings a bottle, and cigarettes at 12 shillings a hundred. He could barter, or, if he preferred, convert them without effort into the local currency, though it was safest to rely on the services of an elderly Hungarian Rittmeister, who sat around registry reading secret files and gazing lovingly at Wolfgang, much as Mr. Cudlove liked to gaze at Ollie. All of it was familiar. All of it was necessary to Pym for the continuation of his unlived orthodox childhood. On Sundays, he escorted the Membrys to Mass, and over lunch looked down the front of Hannah's dress. "Membury is a genius," Pym exulted, as he moved his desk into the great man's anteroom. "Membury is Renaissance man made spy." Within weeks, he had his own imprest. Within a few more, he had a second pip for Wolfgang to sew on his shoulder, for Membury said he looked silly with only one. And he had his Joes, "This is Pepe," McLaird explained with a droll smile, over a discreet dinner out of town. "Pepe fought the Reds for the Germans, and now he's fighting them for us. You're a fanatic anti-communist, aren't you, Pepe? That's why he takes his motorbike into the zone and sells pornographic photographs to the Russian soldiery. 400 players medium a month in arrears." "This is Elsa," McLaird said, presenting a dumpy Corinthian housewife with four children in the grill room of the Blue Rose. "Her boyfriend runs a cafe in St. Pölten. Sends her the registration numbers and insignia of the Russian lorries that go past his window, doesn't he, Elsa? All in secret writing on the back of his love letters. 3 kilos of medium roast coffee a month, in arrears." There were a dozen of them, and Pim set to work immediately to develop and welfare them in every way he knew. Today, when I play them through my memory, they are as fine a bunch of never-wasers as ever came the way of an aspiring spymaster. But to Pim, they were simply the best scouts ever, and he would see them right if it killed him. "And I have left till last Sabina, Jack, who, like her friend Marlena in Vienna, was an interpreter, and like Marlena was the most beautiful girl in the world, plucked straight from the pages of Amour and Rococo Woman. She was small like Eve Weber, with broad, fluid hips and intense, demanding eyes. Her breasts, in summer or winter, were high and very strong, and, like her buttocks, pushed their way through the most workaday clothes, insistently demanding Pim's attention. Her features were those of a gloomy Slav elf, haunted by sadness and superstition, but capable of amazing bursts of sweetness. And if Lipsy had been reincarnated and made 23 again, she could have done a great deal worse than take Sabina's form. "Marlena says you are respectable," she informed Pim with contempt, as she clambered aboard Corporal Kaufman's jeep, not bothering to conceal her rococo legs. "Is that a crime?" Pim asked. "Don't worry," she replied ominously, and away they drove to the camps. Sabina spoke Czech and Serbo-Croat as well as German. In her spare time, she was studying economics at Graz University, which gave her an excuse to talk to Corporal Kaufman. "You are believing in mixed agrarian economy, Kaufman?" "I don't believe any of it." "You are Keynesian?" "I wouldn't be one with my own money, I'll tell you that," said Kaufman. Thus the conversation went back and forth, while Pim searched for ways of brushing carelessly against her white shoulder, or causing her skirt to open a fraction further to the north. Their destination on these journeys was the camps. For 5 years, the refugees of Eastern Europe had been pouring into Austria through every fast-closing gap in the barbed wire, crashing frontiers in stolen cars and lorries, across minefields, clinging to the underneath of trains. They brought their hollow faces and their shorn children and their puzzled old and their frisky dogs and their Lipsies in the making to be corralled and questioned and decided over in their thousands, while they played chess on wooden packing cases and showed each other photographs of people they would never see again. They came from Hungary and Romania and Poland and Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia and sometimes Russia. And they hoped they were on their way to Canada and Australia and Palestine. They had travelled by devious routes and often for devious reasons. They were doctors and scientists and bricklayers. They were truck drivers, thieves, acrobats, publishers, rapists and architects. All passed across Pim's vision as he rode in his jeep from camp to camp with Corporal Kaufman and Sabina, questioning, grading and recording, then hastening home to Membury with his booty. At first his sensitivity was offended by so much misery, and he had a hard time disguising his concern for everyone he spoke to. "Yes, I will see you get to Montreal if it kills me. Yes, I will send word to your mother in Canberra that you are safely here." At first, Pim was also embarrassed by his lack of suffering. Everyone he questioned had had more experience in a day than he had had in his whole young life, and he resented them. Some had been crossing borders since they were children. Others spoke of death and torture so casually that he became indignant at their unconcern, until his disapproval sparked their anger and they flung back at him with mockery. But Pim, the good labourer, had work to do, and a commanding officer to please, and when he armed himself, a quick and covert mind to do it with. He had only to consult his own nature to know when someone was writing in the margin of his memory and excluding the main text. He knew how to make small talk while he was watching, and how to read the signals that came back to him. If they described a night crossing over the hills, Pym crossed with them, lugging their lipsy suitcases and feeling the icy mountain air cutting through their old coats. When one of them told a lie direct, Pym rapidly took back bearings on likely versions of the truth with the aid of his mental compass. Questions teemed in him, and, budding lawyer that he was, he quickly learned to shape them into a pattern of accusation. Where do you come from? What troops did you see there? What colour shoulder boards did they wear? What did they drive around in? What weapons did they have? Which route did you take? What guards, obstructions, dogs, wire, minefields did you meet along your way? What shoes were you wearing? How did your mother manage, your grandmother, if the mountain pass was so steep? How did you cope with two suitcases and two small children when your wife was so heavily pregnant? Is it not more likely that your employers in the Hungarian secret police drove you to the border and wished you luck as they showed you where to cross? Are you a spy? And if so, would you not prefer to spy for us? Or are you merely a criminal, in which case you would surely like to take up spying, rather than be tossed back across the border by the Austrian police? Thus, Pym drew from his own criss-cross lives in order to unravel theirs, and Sabina, with her scowls and moods and occasional gorgeous smiles, became the sultry voice in which he did it. Sometimes he let her translate into German for him, in order to give himself the secret advantage of hearing everything twice. "Where did you learn to play these stupid games?" she asked him sternly one evening, as they danced together at the Hotel Wiesler, to the disapproval of the army wives. Pym laughed. On the brink of manhood, with Sabina's thigh riding against his own, why should he owe anything to anybody? So he invented a story for her about this cunning German he'd known at Oxford, who had turned out to be a spy. "We had a rather weird battle of wits," he confessed, drawing upon hastily created memories. "He used all the tricks in the book, and to start with, I was as innocent as a babe and believed everything he told me. Gradually, the contest got a bit more even." "He was communist?" "As it turned out, yes. He made a show of hiding it, but it slipped out when you really went for him." "He was homosexual?" Sabina asked, voicing an ever-ready suspicion as she squirmed more deeply into him. "Not as far as I could see. He had women in regiments." "He slept only with military women?" "I meant he had large quantities of them. I was using a metaphor." "I think he was wishing to disguise his homosexuality. This is normal." Sabina spoke of her own life as if it belonged to someone she hated. Her stupid Hungarian father had been shot at the border. Her fool mother had died in Prague, attempting to produce a baby for a worthless lover. Her older brother was an idiot and studying to be a doctor in Stuttgart. Her uncles were drunkards and had got themselves shot by the Nazis and the communists. "You want I give you Czech lesson on Saturday?" she asked him one evening, in an even stricter tone than usual, as they drove home, three abreast. "I would like that very much," Pym replied, holding her hand at her side. "I'm really beginning to enjoy it." "I think we make love this time. We shall see," she said severely, at which Kaufmann nearly drove into a ditch. Saturday came, and neither Rick's shadow nor Pym's terrors could prevent him from ringing Sabina's doorbell. He heard a footstep, softer than her usual practical tread. He saw the light spots of her eyes regard him through the eye slit in the door, and did his best to smile in a rugged, reassuring manner. He had brought enough naffy whiskey to banish the guilt of ages, but Sabina had no guilt, and when she opened the door to him, she was naked. Incapable of speech, he stood before her, clutching his carrier bag. In a daze, he watched her reset the security chains, take the bag from his lifeless hands, stalk to the sideboard and unpack it. The day was warm, but she had lit a fire and turned back the bed covers. "You have had many women, Magnus?" she demanded. "Women in the regiments like your bad friend?" I don't think I have, said Pym.
You are homosexual, like all English?
I'm really not. She led him to the bed. She sat him down and unbuttoned his shirt, severely, like Lipsy when she needed something for the laundry van outside. She unbuttoned the rest of him and arranged his clothes over a chair. She guided him onto his back and spread herself over him.
I didn't know, said Pym aloud. Please?
He started to say something, but there was too much to explain, and his interpreter was already occupied. He meant, I didn't know, for all my longing, what I was longing for till now. He meant, I can fly. I can swim on my front and on my back and on my side and on my head. He meant, I'm whole, and I've joined the men at last. It was a balmy Friday afternoon in the villa 6 days later. In the gardens below the windows of Membry's enormous office, the Rittmeister in his lederhosen was shelling peas for Wolfgang. Membry sat at his desk, his battle dress unbuttoned to the waist, while he drafted a questionnaire for trawler captains, which he proposed to send in hundreds to the major fishing fleets. For weeks now he had set his heart on tracing the winter routes of sea trout, and the unit's resources had been hard-pressed to accommodate him.
I've had a rather rum approach made to me, sir,
Pym began, delicately. Somebody claiming to represent a potential defector.
Oh, but how interesting for you, Magnus,
Membry said politely, prizing himself with difficulty from his preoccupations.
I hope it's not another Hungarian frontier guard. I've rather had my fill of them. So is Vienna, I'm sure.
Vienna was a growing worry to Membry, as Membry was to Vienna. Pym had read the painful correspondence between them that Membry kept safely locked at all times in the top left drawer of his flimsy desk. It might only be a question of days before the captain of Fusiliers arrived in person to take charge.
He's not Hungarian, actually, sir, said Pym. He's Czech. He's attached to HQ Southern Command, based outside Prague.
Membry tilted his large head to one side, as if shaking water out of his ear.
Well, that's heartening, he remarked, doubtfully. Divint would give their eye teeth for some good stuff about Southern Czecho, or anywhere else in Czecho, for that matter. The Americans seem to think they have a monopoly of the place. Somebody said as much to me on the telephone only the other day. I don't know who.
The telephone line to Graz ran through the Soviet zone. In the evenings, Russian technicians could be heard on it, singing drunken Cossack music. According to my source, he's a disgruntled clerk sergeant working in their strong room, Pym persisted. He's supposed to be coming out tomorrow night by way of the Soviet zone. If we're not there to receive him, he'll take the shortcut and go direct to the Americans.
You didn't hear of him through the Rittmeister, did you? Said Membry, nervously.
With the skill of long habituation, Pym entered the risky ground. No, it was not the Rittmeister, he assured Membry. At least it didn't sound like the Rittmeister. The voice sounded younger and more positive. Membry was confused.
Could you possibly explain?
He said. Pym did. It was just an ordinary Thursday evening, he said. He'd been to the movies to see Liebe 47, and on his way back he thought he'd drop in at the Weisses Ross for a beer.
I don't think I know the Weisses Ross. It's just another pub, sir, really, but the emigres use it a lot, and everyone sits at long tables. I'd been there literally 2 minutes when the waiter called me to the phone. Herr Leutnant, für Sie. They know me a bit there, so I wasn't too surprised.
Good for you, said Membry, impressed. It was a man's voice speaking High German. Herr Pym, here is an important message for you. If you do exactly as I tell you, you will not be disappointed. Have you pen and paper? I had, so he started reading to me at dictation speed. He checked it back with me and rang off before I could ask who he was. From his pocket, Pym produced the very sheet of paper, torn from the back of a diary.
But if this was last night, why on earth didn't you tell me earlier?
Membry objected, taking it from him.
You were at the Joint Intelligence Committee meeting. Oh, my hat, so I was. He asked for you by name,
Membry remarked with pride, still looking at the paper.
Only Lieutenant Pym will do. That's rather flattering, I must say.
He pulled at a protruding ear.
Well, look here, you take jolly good care.
he warned, with the sternness of a man who could refuse Pym nothing. And don't go too near the border in case they try and haul you over. This was not by any means the first advance tip-off of a defector's arrival that had come Pym's way in recent months, not even the sixth, though it was the first that had been whispered to him by a naked Czech interpreter in a moonlit orchard. Only a week before, Pym and Membry had sat out a night in the Corinthian lowlands, waiting to receive a captain of Romanian intelligence and his mistress, who were supposedly approaching in a stolen aeroplane crammed with priceless secrets. Membry had the Austrian police close off the area. Pym fired coloured vari lights into the empty air, as they had been instructed in secret messages. But when the dawn came, no aeroplane had arrived.
"What are we supposed to do now?"
Membry had complained with pardonable irritation, as they sat shivering in the jeep.
"Sacrifice a bloody goat? I do wish the Rittmeister were more precise. It makes one look so silly."
A week before that, disguised in green loden coats, they had taken themselves to a remote inn on the zonal border in search of a heimkehrer from a Soviet uranium mine, who was expected any moment. As they pushed open the door, the conversation in the bar stopped dead, and a score of peasants gawped at them. "Billiards," Membry ordered, with rare decisiveness, from under his hand. "There's a table over there. We'll get a game going. Fit in." Still in his green loden, Membry stooped to play his ball, only to be interrupted by the resounding clang of heavy metal striking the tiled floor close at hand. Glancing down, Pym saw his commanding officer's .38 service revolver lying at his large feet. He had recovered it for him in a moment, never quicker, but not quick enough to prevent the stampede to the door as the terrified peasants scattered in the darkness and the landlord locked himself in the cellar.
"Can I go back now, sir?" said Kaufman. "I'm not a soldier at all, you see, I'm a coward."
"No, you can't," said Pym. "Now be quiet." The barn stood by itself, as Sabina had said it would, at the centre of a flat field lined with larches. A yellow path led to it. Behind it lay a lake. Behind the lake, a hill, and on the hill, as the evening darkened, a single watchtower overlooked the valley.
"You will wear civilian clothes and park your car at the crossroads to Klein Brandorf," Sabina had whispered to his thighs as she kissed and fondled and revived him.
The orchard had a brick wall and was occupied by a family of large brown hares.
"You will leave sidelights burning. If you cheat and bring protection, he will not appear. He will stay in the forest and be angry."
"I love you."
"There is a stone, painted white. This is where Kaufman must stamp. If Kaufman passes the white stone, he will not appear. He will stay in the forest."
"Why can't you come too?"
"He does not wish it. He wishes only Pym. Perhaps he is homosexual."
"Thanks," said Pym. The white stone glinted ahead of them. "Stay here," Pym ordered.
"Why?"
said Kaufman. Evening mist lay in strips across the field. The surface of the lake popped with rising fish. With the sun setting, the larches threw mile-long shadows across the golden meadow. Sawn logs lay beside the barn door. Boxes of geraniums adorned the windows. Pym thought again of Sabina, her enfolding flanks, the broad spaces of her back.
"What I tell you, I have not told to any Englishman. In Prague, I have a younger brother who is called Jan. If you tell this to Membry, he will already dismiss me immediately. The British do not allow us to have close family inside the communist country. Do you understand?" "Yes, Sabina, I understand. I have seen the moonlight on your breasts. Your moisture is on my lips. It is sticking to my eyelids. I understand." "Listen, my brother sends me this message for you, only for Pym. He trusts you because of me, and because I have told him only good things about you. He has a friend who wishes to come out. This friend is very gifted, very brilliant, top access. He will bring you many secrets about the Russians. But first, you must invent a story for Membry to explain how you received this information. You are clever. You can invent many stories. Now you must invent one for my brother and his friend."
"Yes, Sabina, I can invent.
For you and your beloved brother, I can invent a million stories. Give me my pen, Sabina. Where did you put my clothes?
Now tear me a piece of paper from your diary, and I will invent a story about a strange man who telephoned me at the Vicus Ross and made me an irresistible proposal.
Pym unbuttoned his loden. Always draw across the body, his weapons instructor had advised at the sad little depot in Sussex, where they had taught him how to fight communism. It gives you better protection when the other laddie shoots first. Pym was not sure this was good advice. He reached the door, and it was closed. He walked round the barn, trying to find a place to peep in.
His information will be good for you, Sabina had said. It will make you very famous in Vienna. Memory also. Good intelligence from Czechoslovakia is extremely rare at DivInt. Mostly it comes from the Americans, and is therefore corrupt.
The sun had set, and the dusk was gathering fast. From across the lake, Pym heard the yelping of a fox. Rows of chicken coops stood at the back of the barn, and the straw in them was clean.
Chickens in no man's land, he thought frivolously. Stateless eggs.
The chickens tucked their necks at him and blew out their feathers. A grey heron lifted from the lake and set course towards the hills. He returned to the front of the barn.
Kaufman! Sir!
100 meters lay between them, but their voices were as close as lovers in the evening stillness.
Did you cough?
No, sir.
Well, don't. I expect I was sobbing, sir.
Keep guard. But whatever you see, don't come any nearer unless I order you.
I'd like to desert, if I may, sir. I'd rather be a defector than this, honestly. I'm a sitting target. I'm not a human being at all. Do some mental sums or something. I can't. I've tried. Nothing comes.
Pym lifted the door latch, stepped inside, and smelt cigar smoke and horse.
Samaritz, he thought, light-headed in his apprehension.
The barn was cavernous and beautiful, and raised at one end like an old ship. On the dais stood a table, and on the table, to Pym's surprise, a lighted oil lamp. By its glow, he admired the ancient beams and roof.
Wait inside, and he will come, Sabina had said. He will want to see you go in first. My brother's friend is very cautious. Like many Czechs, he has a great and cautious mind.
Two high-backed wooden chairs were pulled to the table, and magazines were strewn on it like in a dentist's waiting room.
Must be where the farmer does his paperwork.
At one end of the barn, he noticed a rustic ladder leading to a loft.
At the weekend, I'll bring you here. I'll bring wine and cheese and bread and blankets in case it's prickly. You can wear your flouncy skirt with nothing underneath.
He climbed halfway up the ladder and peered over.
Sound floor, dry hay, no sign of rats. An admirable location for rustic rococo.
He returned to the ground floor and made his way towards the dais where the light burned, intending to settle down in one of the chairs.
You must be patient, if necessary, all night, Sabina had said. Crossing the border is extremely dangerous now. It is late summer, and the doubters are coming over before the passes close. Therefore, they have many guards and spies.
A stone pathway ran between two cattle drains. His feet echoed thickly in the roof. The echo stopped, his feet with it. A slender figure was seated at the head of the table. He was leaning alertly forward, posing for something. He held a cigar in one hand and an automatic pistol in the other. His gaze, like the barrel of the automatic, was fixed on Pym.
Keep walking towards me, Sir Magnus,
Axel urged, in a tone of considerable anxiety.
Put your arms up, and for heaven's sake don't go imagining you are a great cowboy or a war hero. Neither of us is a member of the shooting classes. We put our guns away and we have a nice chat. Be reasonable, please.
It would take our maker himself, Tom, with help from all of us, to describe the range of thoughts and emotions charging at that moment through Pym's poor head. His first response, I'm sure, was disbelief. He had encountered Axel very often in the last few years, and this was merely another example of the phenomenon. Axel watching him in his sleep,
Axel standing at his bedside with his beret on. "Let's take another look at Thomas Mann." Axel laughing at him for his addiction to old High German, and remonstrating with him for his bad habit of protesting loyalty to everyone he met, to the Oxford Communists, to all women, to the Jacks and Michaels, and to Rick.
"You are a serious fool, Sir Magnus," he had warned him once, when Pym returned to his rooms after a particularly deft night of juggling girls and social opposites. "You think that by dividing everything, you can pass between."
Axel had limped at his side along the Isis towpath, and watched him dash his knuckles against the wall in order to impress Jemima. At the by-election, Pym could not have told you how often Axel's glistening white dome had popped up in the audience, or his long restive hands flapped in sarcastic applause. With Axel so much upon his conscience, therefore, Pym knew for a fact that Axel did not exist. And with this certainty in his head, it was perfectly reasonable that his next response to seeing Axel was downright indignation that someone so thoroughly forbidden, someone who had been literally, for whatever reason, banished out of sight or mention over the borders of Pym's kingdom, should presume to be sitting here, smoking and smiling, and pointing a pistol at him. But me, Pym, a bulletproof, fornicating member of the British occupational classes, gifted with supernatural powers. And after that, of course, paradoxical as ever, Pym was more exultant, more thrilled, and more happy to see Axel than anyone since the day Rick rode round the corner on his bicycle, singing underneath the arches. Pym walked, then ran to Axel's side. He kept his arms above his head, as Axel ordered him. He waited impatiently while Axel fished his army revolver from his waistband and laid it with his own respectfully at the further end of the table. Then at last he dropped his arms far enough to fling them around Axel's neck. I don't remember that they had ever embraced before, or did so afterwards. But I remember that evening as the last of childish sentiment between them, the last day of Bern, because I see them hugging and laughing, chest to chest, Slav style, before they hold one another at a distance, to see what damage the years of separation have done to each of them. And we may assume from contemporary photographs and from my own memories of the mirror in those days, which still played a large part in the young officer's contemplations, that Axel saw the typical uncut Anglo-Saxon features of a good-looking, fair young man, still trying hard to put on the mantle of experience, whereas in Axel's face, Pym witnessed at once a hardening, a hollowing out, a shaping that was there forever. Axel would look like this for the rest of his days. Life had had its say. He had the manly, human face that he deserved. The softer contours had gone, leaving an etched jauntiness and assurance. His hairline had retreated, but consolidated. Streaks of grey had joined the black, giving it a practical and military appearance. The clown's moustache, the clown's hooped eyebrows, had acquired a sadder humour. But the twinkling dark eyes, peering beneath their languid eyelids, were as merry as ever, while everything around them seemed to give depth to their perception.
"You look well, Sir Magnus," Axel declared exuberantly, still holding him. "You are a fine fellow, my God. We should buy you a white horse and give you India." "But who are you?" Pym cried in equal excitement. "Where are you? What are you doing here? Should I arrest you?"
"Maybe I arrest you. Maybe I did already. You put your hands up, do you remember? Listen, we are in no man's land here. We can arrest each other."
"You're under arrest," Pym said.
"You too," said Axel. "How's Sabina?"
"Fine," Pym said, with a grin.
"She knows nothing, you understand. Only what her brother told her."
"You will protect her?"
"I promise I will," Pym said.
Here a slight pause, as Axel pretended to clap his hands over his ears.
"Don't promise, Sir Magnus. Just don't promise."
For a frontier crossing, Axel had come well equipped, Pym noticed. There was not a trace of mud on his boots. His clothes were pressed and official-looking. Releasing Pym, he grabbed a briefcase, plonked it on the table, and drew from it a pair of glasses and a bottle of vodka, then gherkins, sausage, and a loaf of the black bread he used to send Pym out to buy in Bern. They toasted each other gravely, the way Axel had taught him. They refilled their glasses and drank again, a drink for each man. And it is my recollection that by the time they separated, they had finished the bottle. For I remember Axel chucking it out into the lake, to the outrage of about 1,000 moorhens. But if Pim had drunk a case of the stuff, it would not have affected him. Such was the intensity of his feeling. Even while they began to talk, Pim kept secretly blinking into corners to make sure everything was how it was when he had last looked. So eerily similar at times was the barn to the bairn attic, right down to the soft wind that used to whir in the skylights. And when he heard the fox again in the distance, he had the certain feeling it was Bastl barking on the wooden staircase after everyone had gone. Except that, as I say, those sentimental days were over. Magnus had killed them dead. The manhood of their friendship was beginning. Now it is the way of old friends, when they bump into each other, Tom, to put aside the immediate cause of their meeting until last. They prefer, as a prelude, to account for the years between, which gives a kind of rightness to whatever they have met to discuss. And that is what Pim and Axel did. Though you will understand, now that you are familiar with the workings of Pim's mind, that it was he and not Axel who led this passage of the conversation, if only in order to show to himself, as well as to Axel, that he was totally without sin in the tricky matter of Axel's disappearance. He did it well. He was a polished performer these days. "Honestly, Axel, nobody ever went out of my life so abruptly," he complained, in a tone of jocular reproach, as he sliced sausage, buttered the bread, and generally occupied himself with what actors call business. "You were there, all safely tucked up in the evening. We'd got a bit drunk, said good night. Next morning I hammered on your wall, no answer. I go downstairs and walk into poor old Frau O, crying her heart out. Where's Axel? They've taken away our Axel. The Fremden Polizei carried him down the stairs and one of them kicked Bastl. From all they said, I must have been sleeping like the dead." Axel smiled his old, warm smile. "If we only knew how the dead sleep," he said. "We held a sort of wake, hung around the house, half expecting you to come back. Herr Ollingham made some useless phone calls and got absolutely nowhere, naturally. Frau O remembered she had a brother in one of the ministries. He was no good. In the end, I thought, to hell with it. What have we got to lose? So I went down to the Fremden Polizei myself, passport in hand. My friend's missing. Some men dragged him from the house early this morning. Said they came from you. Where is he? I banged the table a bit and got nowhere. Then two rather creepy gentlemen in raincoats took me into another room and told me that if I made any more trouble, the same thing would happen to me."
"That was brave of you, Sir Magnus," said Axel.
Reaching out a pale fist, he tapped Pim lightly on the shoulder to say thanks.
"No, it wasn't. Not really. I mean, I did have somewhere to go. I was British, and I had rights."
"Sure.
And you knew people at the embassy. That's true also. And they'd have helped me out, too. I mean, they tried to, when I went to them."
"You did?"
"Absolutely. Well, later, of course, not immediately. Rather as a last resort. But they had a go. So anyway, back I went to Lengasse, and we... honestly, we buried you. It was awful. Frau O was up in your room still crying, trying to sort out whatever you'd left behind without looking at it, which wasn't much. The Fremden Polizei seemed to have pinched most of your papers. I took your library books back, your gramophone records. We hung your clothes in the cellar. Then we sort of wandered round the house as if we'd been bombed. To think this could happen in Switzerland, we kept saying. Really, just like a death."
Axel laughed. "It was good of you to mourn me, at least. Thank you, Sir Magnus. Did you hold a funeral service also?"
"With no body and no forwarding address. All Frau O wanted to do was look for a culprit. She was convinced you'd been informed against."
"Who did she think did it?"
"Everyone in turn, really. The neighbours, the shopkeepers, maybe someone from the Cosmo, one of the Marthas."
"Which one did she choose?"
Pim picked the prettiest and frowned. I seem to remember there was a leggy blonde one who was reading English.
Isabella? Isabella informed against me?
Said Axel, incredulously.
But she was in love with me, Sir Magnus. Why would she do that?
Maybe that was the reason, said Pym boldly. She came round a few days after you'd gone, you see, asked for you. I told her what had happened. She howled and wept and said she was going to kill herself. But when I mentioned to Frau O that she'd called, she promptly said, Isabella is the one. She was jealous of his other women, so she informed against him. What did you think? Seemed a bit far-fetched to me, but then everything else did too. So yes, maybe Isabella did it. She did seem a bit crazy sometimes, to be honest. I could sort of imagine her doing something awful out of jealousy, on an impulse, you know, then persuading herself she hadn't done it in the first place. It's a sort of syndrome, isn't it, with jealous people? Axel took his time to reply. For a defector in the throes of negotiating his terms, Pym reflected, he was remarkably relaxed.
I don't know, Sir Magnus. I don't have your gifts of imagination sometimes. Do you have any other theories?
Not really. It could have happened so many ways.
In the silence of the night, Axel replenished their glasses, smiling broadly.
You all seem to have thought about it far more than I have, he confessed. I'm very touched.
He lifted his palms, Slav style, languidly. Listen, I was illegal. I was a bum, no money, no papers, on the run. So they caught me, they threw me out. That's what happens to illegals. A fish gets a hook in its throat. A traitor gets a bullet in his head. An illegal gets marched across the border. Don't frown so much, it's over. Who gives a damn who did it? To tomorrow.
Tomorrow, Pym said, and they drank.
Hey, how did the great book go, by the way?
He asked, in the secret euphoria of his absolution.
Axel laughed louder.
Go? My God, it went! 400 pages of immortal philosophizing, Sir Magnus. Imagine the Fremden and Polizei wading their way through that.
You mean they kept it, stole it? That's outrageous.
Maybe I was not too polite about the good Swiss burgers.
But you've written it again since.
Nothing could quench his laughter.
Written it again? It would have been twice as bad next time. Better we bury it with Axel H. You still have Simplicissimus. You haven't sold him.
Of course not.
A pause intervened. Axel smiled at Pym. Pym smiled at his hands, then raised his eyes to Axel.
So, here we both are, said Pym.
That's right.
I'm Lieutenant Pym, and you're Jan's intelligent friend.
That's right,
Axel agreed, still smiling.
Having thus, in his own estimation, skillfully circumvented the one awkwardness that might have stood between them, the intelligence predator in Pym now artfully advanced upon the pertinent question of what had become of Axel since his eviction, and what his access had been, and so by extension, as Pym hoped, what cards he held, and what price he proposed to put on them, as a reward for favouring the British over the Americans, or even, dreadful thought, the French. In this, he met at first with no unpleasant inhibition on Axel's part, since, doubtless out of deference to Pym's position of authority, he seemed resigned to take the passive role. Nor could Pym fail to notice that his old friend, in rendering account of himself, assumed the familiar meekness of the displaced person in the presence of his betters. The Swiss had marched him across the German border, he said. And for ease of reference, he mentioned the frontier point in case Pym wished to check. They had handed him over to the West German police, who, having dealt him a ritual beating, handed him to the Americans, who beat him again, first for escaping, then for returning, and finally, of course, for being the red-toothed war criminal that he was not, but whose identity he had unwisely purloined. The Americans put him in prison while they prepared a fresh case against him. They brought in fresh witnesses, who were too frightened not to identify him. They set a date to try him, and still Axel could reach nobody who would vouch for him, or say he was just Axel from Karlsbad, and not a Nazi monster. Worse still, as the rest of the evidence began to look increasingly thin, said Axel, with an apologetic smile, his own confession became increasingly important. So they had naturally beaten him harder in order to obtain it. No trial was held, however. War crimes, even fictitious ones, were becoming out of date. So one day the Americans had thrown him on another train and handed him over to the Czechs, who, not to be outdone, beat him for the double crime of having been a German soldier in the war and an American prisoner after it. "Then one day they stopped beating me and let me out," he said, smiling and opening his hands once more. "For this, it seems, I had my dear dead father to thank. You remember the great socialist who had fought in the Telman Brigade in Spain?" "Of course I do," said Pym. And it occurred to him, as he watched Axel's quick hands gesticulating and his dark eyes twinkling, that Axel had put aside the German in him and put on the Slav for good. "I had become an aristocrat," he said. "In the new Czechoslovakia, I was Sir Axel suddenly. The old socialists had loved my father. The new ones had been my friends at school and were already in the party apparatus. 'Why do you beat up Sir Axel?' they asked my guards. 'He's got a good brain. Stop hitting him and let him out.' 'Okay, so he fought for Hitler. He's sorry. Now he'll fight for us, won't you, Axel?' 'Sure,' I said. 'Why not?' So they sent me to university."
"But what did you study?" said Pym, amazed. "Thomas Mann? Nietzsche?"
"Better. How to use the party to advance oneself. How to rise in the youth union. Shine in the committees. How to purge the faculties and students. Climb over the backs of friends and the reputation of one's father. Which asses to kick and which to kiss. Where to talk too much and where to shut your mouth. Maybe I should have learned that earlier." Feeling he was close to the heart of things, Pym wondered whether it was time for him to take notes, but decided not to destroy Axel's flow.
"Somebody had the nerve to call me a Titoist the other day," Axel said. "Since 49, it's the latest insult."
Pym secretly wondered whether this was why Axel had come over.
"Know what I did?"
"What?"
"I informed against him."
"No.
What for?"
"I don't know. Something bad."
"It's not what you say, it's who you say it to. You should know that." "You're a big spy, I hear. Sub Magnus of the British Secret Service. Congratulations."
"Is Corporal Kaufman all right out there? Maybe you should take him something."
"I'll deal with him later, thank you."
There was a hiatus, while each in his separate way savored the effect of this disciplinary note. They drank another toast, shaking their heads at one another over their luck. But inside himself, Pym was less at ease than he let on. He had a sense of slipping standards and complicated undertones.
"So what work have you actually been up to these last days?" Pym asked, struggling to reclaim the ascendancy. "How does a sergeant from HQ Southern Command come to be wandering round the Soviet zone of Austria, planning his defection?"
Axel was lighting himself a fresh cigar, so Pym had to wait a moment for his answer.
"A sergeant? I don't know. In my unit we have only aristos. Like you. I am also a great spy, Sir Magnus. It's a boom industry these days. We did well to select it."
Needing suddenly to tend his outward appearance, Pym smoothed his hair back, in a reflective gesture he was working on.
"But you are still proposing to come over to us, assuming that we can offer you the right sort of terms, of course?" he asked, with hard-edged courtesy.
Axel waved away such a stupid idea.
"I've paid my ticket, same as you. So it's not perfect, but it's my country. I've crossed my last frontier. They've got to put up with me."
Pym had a sensation of dangerous disconnection.
"Then why are you here if you don't want to defect, if I may ask?" "I heard about you. The great Lieutenant Pym of Div Int, more latterly of Graz. Linguist, hero, lover.
I was so excited to think of you spying on me, and me spying on you. It was so beautiful to think we were back in our old attic together. Just that little thin wall between us. Knock, knock. I've got to get in touch with this fellow, I thought. Shake his hand. Give him a drink. Maybe we can set the world to rights. Same as we used to in the old days.
I see, said Pim. Great. Maybe we can put our heads together. We are reasonable men. Maybe he doesn't want to fight any more wars. Maybe I don't. Maybe we are tired of being heroes. Good men are scarce, I thought.
How many people in the world have shaken hands with Thomas Mann?
Nobody but me, said Pim, with a burst of real laughter. They drank again.
I owe you so much, Sir Magnus. You are so generous. I never knew a better heart. I yelled at you, cursed you. What did you do? Held my head when I threw up. Cooked me tea. Cleaned the vomit and the shit off me. Fetched me books back and forth to the library. Read to me all night. I owe this man, I thought. I owe this man a step or two forward in his career. I should make him a gesture that is painful to me. If I can help him achieve a position of influence in the world, that's rare. That's already good. For the world as well as for him. Not many good men achieve a position of influence today. So I'll play a little trick and go and see him and shake his hand and say thank you, Sir Magnus, and take him a gift to pay my debt to him and help him in his career, I thought. Because I love this man, do you hear?
He had brought no straw hat filled with coloured packages, but from the briefcase he drew a folder and handed it to Pym across the table.
You have landed a great coup, Sir Magnus, he declared proudly as Pym lifted the cover. Took me a lot of spying to get it for you, a lot of risks, never mind. It's better than Grimmelshausen, I think. If they ever find out what I've done, I can bring you my balls as well.
Pym closes his eyes and opened them again, but it is the same night in the same barn.
I'm a little fat Czech sergeant who loves his vodka, Axel is explaining, while Pym continues in a dream to turn the pages of his gift. I'm a good soldier, Schweik. Did we read that book? My name is Pavel. Hear me, Pavel.
Of course we read it. It was great.
Is this genuine, Axel? It isn't a joke or anything.
You think fat Pavel takes a risk like this to bring you a joke? He has a wife who beats him, kids who hate him, Russian bosses who treat him worse than a dog. Are you listening?
With half his head, yes, Pym is listening. He is reading, too.
Your good friend, Axel H. He doesn't exist. You never met him tonight. In Bern, long ago, sure, you met a sickly German soldier who was writing a great book, and maybe his name was Axel. What's her name? But Axel vanished. Some bad guy informed against him. You never knew what happened.
Today you are meeting Fat Sergeant Pavel of Czech Army Intelligence, who likes garlic and screwing and betraying his superiors. He speaks German and Czech, and the Russians use him as a dog's body because they don't trust the Austrians. One week he's hanging around their headquarters in Wiener Neustadt, playing messenger boy and interpreter. The next, he's freezing his ass off on the zonal border, looking for small spies. The week after that, he's back in the garrison in southern Czechia, being kicked around by more Russians.
Axel is tapping Pim's arm. See this? Pay attention. Here's a copy of his paybook. Look at it, Sir Magnus.
Concentrate. He brought it for you because he doesn't expect anybody ever to believe anything he says, unless it is accompanied by Unterlagen. You remember Unterlagen? Papers?
They are what I didn't have in Bern. Take it with you. Show it to Membury.
Reluctantly, Pym lifts his eyes from his reading long enough to notice the wad of glossy paper Axel is